what? It's W.B. Yeats's house, with a blue plaque over the door saying he lived there. At Primrose Hill, she would write in the early morning hours while her children slept. Her productivity was extraordinary. In December, she finished a poetry collection, and her publisher told her it should win the Pulitzer Prize. She was on her way to becoming one of the most celebrated young poets in the world, a reputation that would only grow in the coming years. But in late December, a deadly cold settled on England. It was one of the bitterest winters in 300 years. The snow began falling and would not stop. People skated on the Thames. Water pipes froze solid. There were power outages and labor strikes. Plath had struggled with depression all her life, and now the darkness returned. Her friend, literary critic Alfred Alvarez, came to see her on Christmas Eve. She seemed different, he remembered in his memoir, The Savage God. Her hair, which she usually wore in a tight schoolmistressy bun, was loose. It hung straight to her waist like a tent, giving her pale face and gaunt figure a curiously desolate, rapt air, like a priestess emptied out by the rites of her cult. When she walked in front of me down the hall passage, her hair gave off a strong smell, sharp as an animal's. Her apartment was spare and cold, barely furnished and with little in the way of Christmas decorations for her children. For the unhappy, Alvarez wrote, Christmas is always a bad time. The terrible false jollity that comes at you from every side, braying about goodwill and peace and family fun, makes loneliness and depression particularly hard to bear. I had never seen her so strained. They each had a glass of wine, and following their habit, she read to him her latest poems. They were dark. The new year came, and the weather grew even worse. Plath feuded with her ex-husband. She fired her au pair. She gathered her children and went to stay at the house of Jillian and Jerry Becker, who lived nearby. I feel terrible, she said. She took some antidepressants, fell asleep, then woke up in tears. That was a Thursday. On Friday, she wrote her ex-husband, Ted Hughes, what he would later call a farewell note. On Sunday, she insisted that Jerry Becker drive her and her children back to their apartment. He left her in the early evening, after she had put her children to bed. At some point over the next few hours, she left some food and water for her children in their room and opened their bedroom window. She wrote out the name of her doctor with a telephone number and stuck it to the baby carriage in the hallway. Then she took towels, dishcloths, and tape and sealed the kitchen door. She turned on the gas in her kitchen stove, placed her head inside the oven, and took her own life. Poets die young. That is not just a cliché. The life expectancy of poets as a group trails playwrights, novelists, and non-fiction writers by a considerable margin. They have higher rates of emotional disorders than actors, musicians, composers, and novelists. And of every occupational category, poets have far and away the highest suicide rates, as much as 5 times higher than the general population. Something about writing poetry appears either to attract the wounded or to open new wounds, and few have so perfectly embodied that image of the doomed genius as Sylvia Plath. Plath was obsessed with suicide. She wrote about it, thought about it. She talked about suicide in much the same tone as she talked about any other risky testing activity. Urgently, even fiercely, but altogether without self-pity, Alvarez wrote. She seemed to view death as a physical challenge she had once again overcome. It was an experience of much the same quality as careening down a dangerous slope without properly knowing how to ski. She fulfilled every criterion of elevated suicide risk. She had tried it before. She was a former mental patient. She was an American living in a foreign culture, dislocated from family and friends. She was from a broken home, and she had just been rejected by a man she idolized. On the night of her death, Plath left her coat and keys behind at the Beckers. In Gillian Becker's book on Plath, she interprets the keys as a sign of the finality of Plath's decision. Had she supposed that Jerry or I would come after her during the night with her coat and keys? No. She had not expected or wanted to be saved at the last moment from self-inflicted death. The coroner's report stated that Plath had placed her head as far inside the oven as she could, as if she were determined to succeed. Becker writes, "She'd blocked the cracks at the bottom of the doors to the landing and the sitting room, turned all the gas taps full on, neatly folded a kitchen cloth and placed it on the floor of the oven, and laid her cheek on it." Can there be any doubt about her intentions? Just listen to what she was writing in the days before she took her own life.
"The woman is perfected. Her dead body wears the smile of accomplishment. Her bare feet seem to be saying, 'We have come so far. It is over.'"
We hear Sylvia Plath's poetry and her history and catch glimpses of her inner life, and we think we understand her. But there's something we're forgetting, and that's another of the mistakes we make with strangers. In the years after the First World War, many British homes began to use what was called town gas to power their stoves and water heaters. It was manufactured from coal and was a mixture of a variety of different compounds: hydrogen, methane, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and most importantly, the odorless and deadly carbon monoxide. That last fact gave virtually everyone a simple means of committing suicide right inside their home. The victims in the great majority of cases are found with their heads covered with coats or blankets and with a tube from a gas tap brought under the edge of the covering article, a physician wrote in 1927 in one of the first accounts of the lethal properties of town gas. In several instances, persons had been found sitting in a chair with the gas tube close or in the mouth and still held in position by the hand, or they had been found lying on the floor with the head in a gas oven. In one case, a woman was found with a mask which she had made out of a tea cozy tied over her face, the gas tube having been introduced through a hole in the top of the cozy. In 1962, the year Sylvia Plath took her own life, 5,588 people in England and Wales committed suicide. Of those, a little more than 44% killed themselves the way Sylvia Plath did. Carbon monoxide poisoning was by then the leading cause of lethal self-harm in the United Kingdom. Nothing else, not overdosing on pills or jumping off a bridge, came close. But in that same period, the 1960s, the British gas industry underwent a transformation. Town gas was increasingly expensive and dirty. Large reserves of natural gas were discovered in the North Sea, and the decision was made to convert the nation from town gas to natural gas. The scale of the project was immense. Natural gas had markedly different chemical properties than town gas. It required twice as much oxygen to burn cleanly. The flame moved far more slowly, and the pressure of the gas needed to be greater. These facts, in combination, meant the size and shape of the gas ports and burners on the stoves inside virtually every English household were now obsolete. Every gas appliance in England had to be upgraded or replaced. Meters, cookers, water heaters, refrigerators, portable heaters, boilers, washing machines, solid fuel grates, and on and on. New refineries had to be built, new gas mains constructed. One official at the time, without exaggeration, called it the greatest peacetime operation in this nation's history. The long process began in 1965 with a pilot project on a tiny island 30 miles from London with 7,850 gas customers. Yorkshire and Staffordshire were next, then Birmingham, and slowly every apartment house, office, and factory in the country was converted one by one. It took a decade, and by the fall of 1977, the process was finally complete. Town gas was replaced with natural gas, which contained no carbon monoxide at all. After 1977, if you stuck your head in an oven and turned on the gas, the worst that could happen to you was a mild headache and a crick in your neck. So here is the question. Once the number one form of suicide in England became a physiological impossibility, did the people who wanted to kill themselves switch to other methods? Or did the people who would have put their heads in ovens now not commit suicide at all? The assumption that people would simply switch to another method is called displacement. Displacement assumes that when people think of doing something as serious as committing suicide, they are very hard to stop. Blocking one option isn't going to make much of a difference. Sylvia Plath, for example, had a long history of emotional instability. She was treated with electroshock therapy for depression while still in college. She made her first suicide attempt in 1953. She spent 6 months in psychiatric care at McLean Hospital outside Boston. A few years later, she deliberately drove her car into a river, then, in typical fashion, wrote a poem about it.
I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. And like the cat, I have 9 times to die. This is number 3.
In her final act, she meticulously blocked every gap in the doorway, turned the gas taps full on, and stuck her head as far as possible into the oven. She was determined. If she couldn't have used her oven to kill herself, wouldn't she just have tried something else? The alternative possibility is that suicide is a behavior coupled to a particular context. Coupling is the idea that behaviors are linked to very specific circumstances and conditions. My father read Charles Dickens's A Tale of Two Cities to me and my brothers when we were children. And at the very end, when Sidney Carton dies in Charles Darnay's place, my father wept. My father was not a weeper. He was not someone whose emotions bubbled over in every emotionally meaningful moment. He didn't cry in sad movies. He didn't cry when his children left for college. Maybe he got stealthily misty-eyed from time to time, but not so anyone other than maybe my mother would notice. In order to cry, he needed his children on the sofa listening, and he needed one of history's most sentimental novelists. Take away either of those two factors, and no one would ever have seen his tears. That's coupling. If suicide is coupled, then it isn't simply the act of depressed people. It's the act of depressed people at a particular moment of extreme vulnerability and in combination with a particular readily available lethal means. So which is it? Displacement or coupling? The modernization of British gas is an almost perfect way to test this question. If suicide follows the path of displacement, if the suicidal are so determined that when you block one method, they will simply try another, then suicide rates should have remained pretty steady over time, fluctuating only with major social events. Suicides, for example, tend to fall in wartime and rise in times of economic distress. If suicide is coupled, on the other hand, then it should vary with the availability of particular methods of committing suicide. When a new and easy method such as town gas arrives on the scene, suicide should rise. When that method is taken away, they should fall. The suicide curve should look like a roller coaster. And sure enough, according to data on suicide rates in 20th century Britain, it's a roller coaster. It goes way up when town gas first makes its way into British homes, and it comes plunging down as the changeover to natural gas begins in the late 1960s. In that 10-year window, as town gas was being slowly phased out, thousands of deaths were prevented. Town gas had unique advantages as a lethal method, criminologist Ronald Clark wrote in his classic 1988 essay laying out the first sustained argument in favor of coupling. It was widely available in about 80% of British homes and required little preparation or specialist knowledge, making it an easy choice for less mobile people and for those coming under sudden, extreme stress. It was painless, did not result in disfigurement, and did not produce a mess, which women in particular will try to avoid. Deaths by hanging, asphyxiation, or drowning all usually demand more planning, while more courage would be needed with the more violent methods of shooting, cutting, stabbing, crashing one's car, and jumping off high places or in front of trains or buses. There's something awfully matter-of-fact about that paragraph, isn't there? Nowhere in Clark's article does he speak empathetically about the suicidal or dwell on the root causes of their pain. He analyzes the act the way an engineer would look at a mechanical problem. And that approach was radical for the field. I reached Clark by phone to ask him about the response to his thesis of coupling.
The whole idea wasn't very popular at all amongst psychiatrists and social workers and so on. They thought it was very superficial. But, you know, these people were so upset and demoralized that it was sort of insulting to think you could deal with it by simply making it harder to commit suicide. I got quite a lot of pushback here and there from people about that idea.
This simply isn't the way we talk about suicide. We act as if the method were irrelevant. When gas was first introduced into British homes in the 1920s, two government commissions were created to consider the new technology's implications. Neither mentioned the possibility that it might lead to increased suicides. When the official British government report on the gas modernization program came out in 1970, it stated that one of the positive side effects of the transition to natural gas would be a decline in fatal accidents. It didn't even mention suicide, even though the number of people who killed themselves deliberately with gas far exceeded the number who died from it accidentally. In 1981, the most comprehensive academic work on the subject, A History of the British Gas Industry, was published. It goes into extraordinary detail about every single aspect of the advent and growth of gas heating and gas stoves in English life. Does it mention suicide, even in passing? No. I haven't even mentioned the biggest example of how our inability to understand suicide costs lives. Roughly 40,000 Americans commit suicide every year, half of whom do so by shooting themselves. Handguns are the suicide method of choice in the United States, and the problem with that, of course, is that handguns are uniquely deadly. Handguns are America's town gas. What would happen if the U.S. did what the British did and somehow eradicated its leading cause of suicide? It's not hard to imagine. It would uncouple the suicidal from their chosen method, and those few who were determined to try again would be forced to choose from far less deadly options, such as overdosing on pills, which is 55 times less likely to result in death than using a gun. A very conservative estimate is that banning handguns would save 10,000 lives a year just from thwarted suicides. That's a lot of people. Or consider the inexplicable saga of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Since it opened in 1937, it has been the site of more than 1,500 suicides. No other place in the world has seen as many people take their lives in that period. What does coupling theory tell us about the Golden Gate Bridge? That it would make a big difference if a barrier prevented people from jumping, or a net was installed to catch them before they fell. The people prevented from killing themselves on the bridge wouldn't go on to jump off something else. Their decision to commit suicide is coupled to that particular bridge. Sure enough, this is exactly what seems to be the case, according to a very clever bit of detective work by psychologist Richard Seiden. Seiden followed up on 515 people who had tried to jump from the bridge between 1937 and 1971, but had been unexpectedly restrained. Just 25 of those 515 persisted in killing themselves some other way. Overwhelmingly, the people who want to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge at a given moment want to jump off the Golden Gate Bridge only at that given moment. So when did the municipal authority that runs the bridge finally decide to install a suicide barrier? In 2018, more than 80 years after the bridge opened. As John Bateson points out in his book, The Final Leap, in the intervening period, the bridge authority spent millions of dollars building a traffic barrier to protect cyclists crossing the bridge, even though no cyclist has ever been killed by a motorist on the Golden Gate Bridge. It spent millions building a median to separate north and southbound traffic on the grounds of public safety. On the southern end of the bridge, the authority put up an 8-foot cyclone fence to prevent garbage from being thrown onto Fort Baker, a former army installation on the ground below. A protective net was even installed during the initial construction of the bridge at enormous cost to prevent workers from falling to their deaths. The net saved 19 lives. Then it was taken down. But for suicides? Nothing for more than 80 years. Now, why is this? Is it because the people managing the bridge are callous and unfeeling? Not at all. It's because it's really hard for us to accept the idea that a behavior can be so closely coupled to a place. Over the years, the bridge authority periodically asked the public to weigh in on whether it supported the building of a suicide barrier. The letters generally fell into two categories. Those in favor tended to be people whose loved ones had committed suicide, who had some understanding of the psychology of the suicidal. The balance, in fact, the majority, simply dismissed the idea of coupling out of hand. We had actors read a sampling of the letters to the bridge authority.
If a physical barrier on the bridge were to be erected, it would not surprise me if after 3 months, a suicide-prone individual would walk to the North Tower with a pistol and put the gun to his head in frustration of not being able to jump. What then of the millions to erect a physical suicide barrier?
People bent on suicide will find many ways to do away with themselves. Pills, hanging, drowning, cutting arteries, jumping from any other bridge or building. Wouldn't it be much better to spend the money on mental health care for many people instead of worrying about the few that jump off bridges?
I oppose the construction of a suicide barrier because it would waste money and achieve nothing. Anyone who is prevented from jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge would find another, more destructive way of killing himself or herself. Someone who jumps off a tall building would be much more likely to kill someone who is walking in the street than someone who jumps off the bridge into the water.
All it will do is cost money and deface the bridge. There are many ways to commit suicide. You take one away from someone, it will only be replaced by another.
In one national survey, 3/4 of Americans predicted that when a barrier is finally put up on the Golden Gate Bridge, most of those who wanted to take their life on the bridge would simply take their life some other way. But that's absolutely wrong. Suicide is coupled. Default to truth and the illusion of transparency have to do with our inability to make sense of a stranger as an individual. But on top of those errors, we add another, which pushes our problem with strangers into crisis. We do not understand the importance of the context in which the stranger is operating. Brooklyn's 72nd Precinct covers the neighborhoods surrounding Greenwood Cemetery, from Prospect Expressway in the north to Bay Ridge in the south. In the narrow strip between the western perimeter of the cemetery and the waterfront, a series of streets run downhill towards the water. A crumbling, elevated freeway meanders down the middle. Today, it is a gentrifying neighborhood. It was not 30 years ago, when David Weisberg spent a year walking up and down those streets. I met Weisberg recently at a crowded restaurant in Manhattan to talk about his days walking the 72nd Precinct.
This was a different world, you know. This was a scary place. You'd go into an apartment building, there'd be refrigerators in the hall. I mean, garbage would be in the halls. Apartment buildings would have backyards 5 foot deep. There were people on the streets who scared the hell out of you.
Weisberg was a criminologist by training. He had done his dissertation at Yale University on violent behavior among settlers in the West Bank in Israel. He was born in Brooklyn. After leaving Yale, he got a job working on a research project back in his old borough. The study was based out of the Precinct House on 4th Avenue, a squat, modernist box that looked as if it was designed to repel an invading army. There were 9 officers involved, each assigned to a beat of 10 to 30 blocks.
And their job was to walk around those beat areas and to interact with the public and to develop ways of doing something about the problems.
Weisbird was the observer and note taker, responsible for writing up what was learned. 4 days a week, for a year, he tagged along. He had been studying crime in a library. Now he was at ground level, walking side by side with beat cops. And right from the beginning, something struck him as odd. Common sense had always held that crime was connected to certain neighborhoods. Where there were problems, such as poverty, drugs, and family dysfunction, there was crime. The broad conditions of economic and social disadvantage bred communities of lawlessness and disorder. In Los Angeles, that neighborhood was South Central. In Paris, it was the outer suburbs. In London, places like Brixton. Weisbird was in New York's version of one of those neighborhoods. Only the neighborhood wasn't at all what he had imagined.
What I found was, quite quickly, that we, after they got to know the area, we spent all our time in one or two streets. Whereas the bad neighbor to town, most of the streets didn't have any crime.
After a while, it seemed almost pointless to walk every street in his patrol area, since on most of them, nothing ever happened. He didn't understand it. Criminals were people who operated outside social constraint. They were driven by their own dark impulses, mental illness, greed, despair, anger. Weisbird had been taught the best way to understand why criminals did what they did was to understand who they were.
I call it the Dracula Mount. Most criminologists would not like the term Dracula Mount, but that's what I call it, because it's a model about people driven to crime that says that people are so highly motivated to commit crime, nothing else really matters.
Yet if criminals were like Dracula, driven by an insatiable desire to create mayhem, they should have been roaming throughout the 72nd. The kinds of social conditions that Draculas feed on were everywhere. But the Draculas weren't everywhere. They were only on particular streets. And by streets, Weisbird meant a single block, a street segment. You can have one street segment with lots of crime, and the next, literally across an intersection, was fine. It was that specific. Didn't criminals have legs, cars, subway tokens? Like most other criminologists, Weisbird had been studying people. He started to think maybe he ought to be more concerned with places. When he finished his stint in Brooklyn, Weisbird decided to team up with Larry Sherman, another young criminologist. Sherman had been thinking along these geographic lines as well.
I was inspired at the time by the AIDS map of the country, which showed that 50 census tracts out of 50,000 had over half of the AIDS cases in the United States.
AIDS didn't look to Sherman like a contagious disease roaming wildly and randomly across the land. It looked to him like an interaction between certain kinds of people and certain very specific places, an epidemic with its own internal logic. Gathering the kind of data necessary to study the geographical component of crime wasn't easy. Crime had always been reported by precinct, by the general geographical area where it occurred. But Weisbird had just walked the 72nd precinct, and he knew an area that nonspecific wouldn't help them. They needed addresses. Luckily, Sherman knew the police chief in Minneapolis, who was willing to help. Sherman crunched the numbers and found something that seemed hard to believe. 3.3% of the street segments in the city accounted for more than 50% of the police calls. Weisbird and his graduate students at Rutgers University then put a map of Minneapolis on the wall and pasted little strips of paper wherever they found there had been a crime. The unbelievable finding was now impossible to dismiss. From his days walking the 72nd, Weisbird had expected some concentration of crime, but not this. In Boston, right around the same time, another criminologist did a similar study. Half the crime in the city came from 3.6% of the city's blocks. That made two examples. Weisberg decided to look wherever he could. New York, Seattle, Cincinnati. Sherman looked in Kansas City, Dallas. Anytime someone asked, the two of them would run the numbers. And every place they looked, they saw the same thing. Crime in every city was concentrated in a tiny number of street segments. Weisberg decided to try a foreign city, somewhere entirely different, culturally, geographically, economically. His family was Israeli, so he thought, Tel Aviv. Same thing.
And I said, oh my God, look at that. Why should it be that 5% of the streets in Tel Aviv produce 50% of the crime? There's this thing going on in places that are so different.
Weisberg refers to this as the law of crime concentration. Like suicide, crime is tied to very specific places and contexts. And Weisberg's experiences in the 72nd Precinct and in Minneapolis are not idiosyncratic. They capture something close to a fundamental truth about human behavior. And that means that when you confront the stranger, you have to ask yourself where and when you're confronting the stranger. Because those two things powerfully influence your interpretation of who the stranger is. So, Sylvia Plath. In her thinly disguised autobiography, The Bell Jar, Plath's protagonist, Esther Greenwood, describes her descent into madness. And she thinks about suicide precisely as Ronald Clark, the criminologist who made the link between town gas and suicide, suggests she would. She is incredibly sensitive to the question of how she'll take her own life. If you were going to kill yourself, how would you do it? Esther asked Cal, a young man she's lying next to on a beach. Cal seemed pleased. I'd often thought of that. I'd blow my brains out with a gun. Esther thinks, I was disappointed. It was just like a man to do it with a gun. A fat chance I had of laying my hands on a gun, and even if I did, I wouldn't have a clue as to what part of me to shoot at. That very morning, Esther had tried to hang herself with the silk cord of her mother's bathrobe, and it hadn't worked. But each time I would get the cord so tight, I could feel a rushing in my ears and a flush of blood in my face. My hands would weaken and let go, and I would be all right again. She and Cal swim for the shore. She decides to try and drown herself and dives for the bottom of the sea. I dived and dived again, and each time popped up like a cork. The gray rock mocked me, bobbing on the water easy as a life buoy. I knew when I was beaten. I turned back. Plath's protagonist wasn't looking to kill herself. She was looking for a way to kill herself, and not just any method would do. That's the point of coupling. Behaviors are specific. She needed to find a method that fit. And on that cold December night, the method that fit for Sylvia Plath happened to be right there in her kitchen.
If you only knew how the veils were killing my days. To you, they are only transparencies. Clear air.
This is Plath's poem, A Birthday Present, which she wrote in September 1962 at the beginning of her anguished final months in London.
But my God, the clouds are like cotton. Armies of them. They are carbon monoxide. Sweetly, sweetly I breathe in, filling my veins with invisibles.
In the early 1960s, when Plath committed suicide, the suicide rate for women of her age in England reached a staggering 10 per 100,000, driven by a tragically high number of deaths by gas poisoning. That is as high as the suicide rate for women in England has ever been. By 1977, when the natural gas changeover was complete, the suicide rate for young women was roughly half that. Plath was really unlucky. Had she come along 10 years later, there would have been no clouds like carbon monoxide for her to sweetly, sweetly breathe in. In the fall of 1958, 2 years after their wedding, Sylvia Plath and her husband, Ted Hughes, moved to Boston. The poetry that would make her famous was still several years away. Plath worked as a receptionist at the psychiatric unit of Massachusetts General Hospital. In the evenings, she took a writing seminar at Boston University. There, she met another young poet by the name of Anne Sexton. Sexton was 4 years older than Plath, glamorous, charismatic, and strikingly beautiful. She would later win the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry for her book Live or Die, establishing her reputation as one of the most formidable contemporary American poets. Plath and Sexton became friends. They would linger after class, then go out for drinks with another young poet, George Starbuck. We would pile into the front seat of my old Ford, and I would drive quickly through the traffic to or near the Ritz, Sexton recalled in an essay written after Plath's death. I would park illegally in a loading-only zone, telling them gaily, "It's okay, because we're only going to get loaded." Off we'd go, each on George's arm, into the Ritz and drink 3 or 4 or 2 martinis. Sexton and Plath were both young, preternaturally gifted, and obsessed with death. Often, very often, Sylvia and I would talk at length about our first suicides. At length, in detail, and in depth between the free potato chips. Suicide is, after all, the opposite of the poem. Sylvia and I often talked opposites. We talked death with a burned-up intensity, both of us drawn to it like moths to an electric light bulb. Sexton came from a family with a history of mental illness. She suffered from wild mood swings, anorexia, depression, and alcoholism. She attempted suicide at least 5 times. She stole a bottle of the barbiturate Nembutal, deadly in large enough doses, from her parents' medicine cabinet and carried it around in her purse. As her biographer Diane Wood Middlebrook explains, Sexton wanted to be prepared to kill herself anytime she was in the mood. In her early 40s, she went into decline. Her drinking got worse. Her marriage failed. Her writing deteriorated. On the morning of October 4th, 1974, Sexton had breakfast with an old friend, then lunch with another friend, as if saying goodbye. Middlebrook writes, "She stripped her fingers of rings, dropping them into her big purse, and from the coat closet she took her mother's old fur coat. Though it was a sunny afternoon, a chill was in the air. The worn satin lining must have warmed quickly against her flesh. Death was going to feel something like an embrace, like falling asleep in familiar arms. She poured herself a vodka and took her own life. Like her friend Sylvia Plath, Sexton will forever be in the category of doomed genius. No one who knew Anne Sexton well was surprised by her suicide, Middlebrook writes. I hope by now, however, that you aren't satisfied with this account of Sexton's death. If suicide is a coupled act, then Sexton's character and pathology should be only part of the explanation for what happened to her. The same is true for Plath. Her friend Alfred Alvarez believed that far too many people have painted her as the poet as sacrificial victim, offering herself up for the sake of her art. And he's absolutely right. That distorts who she is. It says her identity was tied up entirely in her self-destructiveness. Coupling, on the other hand, forces us to see the stranger in her full ambiguity and complexity. David Weisbord has a map that I think makes this point even more powerfully. It's from Jersey City, just across the Hudson River from Manhattan. The triangular area in the middle, bounded by Cornelison Avenue, Grand Street, and Fairmont Avenue, is a prostitution hotspot and has been for some time. A few years ago, Weisbord conducted an experiment in which he assigned 10 extra police officers, an extraordinarily high number, to patrol those few blocks. Not surprisingly, the amount of prostitution in the area fell by 2/3. Weisbord was most interested, though, in what happened just outside the triangle. When the police cracked down, did the sex workers simply move 1 or 2 streets over? Weisbord had trained observers stationed in the area talking to the sex workers. Was there displacement? There was not. It turns out that most would rather try something else, leave the field entirely, change their behavior, than shift their location. They weren't just coupled to place. They were anchored to place.
People say to us, like, you know, I'm in this area. I don't want to move because it'll make it harder. My customers might know. I have to build up a business again. In other words, there are all these objective reasons why they're not moving. Another reason would be if I go someplace else that's good for, like, drugs, to sell drugs, there's already people there. They'll kill me.
The easiest way to make sense of a sex worker is to say that she is someone compelled to turn tricks, a prisoner of her economic and social circumstances. She's someone different from the rest of us. But what is the first thing the sex workers said when asked to explain their behavior? That moving was really stressful, which is the same thing that everyone says about moving. Weisberg continues.
They talked about hard for business, they have to reestablish themselves. They talked about danger, people they don't know. By the way, in ways you wouldn't think about. What do they mean by people they won't know? Here I know who's going to call the police and who won't call the police, right? That's a big issue for them. When they're in the same place, they begin to have a high level of correct prediction about people. Going to a new place, you don't know who those people are. Someone who looks bad could be good. Someone who looks good from their perspective could be bad.
One of his interviewers asked, why not go four blocks away to another prostitution site?
He said, well, why don't you just go four blocks away? There's another prostitution site. Her response, those are not my type of girls. I don't feel comfortable there. That hit me. Even people with these tremendous problems, with these tremendous difficulties in life, they respond to many of the same things you or I do.
Some of them may have children in nearby schools and grocery stores where they shop and friends they like to be close to and parents they need to look in on, and as a result have all kinds of reasons not to move their business. Their job at that moment is sex work. But they are also mothers and daughters and friends and citizens. Coupling forces us to see the stranger in her full ambiguity and complexity. Was Anne Sexton determined to take her own life by any means possible? Not at all. She would never use a gun. For Ernest Hemingway to shoot himself with a gun in the mouth is the greatest act of courage I can think of, she told her therapist. I worry about the minutes before you die, that fear of death. I don't have it with the pills, but with a gun there'd be a minute when you'd know a terrible fear. I'd do anything to escape that fear. Her chosen method was pills downed with alcohol, which she considered the woman's way out. But people who overdose on pills die only 1.5% of the time, so Sexton was coupled to a method of suicide that was highly unlikely to kill her. That is not a coincidence. Like many people with suicidal tendencies, she was profoundly ambivalent about taking her own life. She took sleeping pills nearly every night, tiptoeing up to the line between dose and overdose, but never crossing it. Just listen to her rationale in her poem, The Addict.
Sleepmonger, deathmonger, with capsules in my palms each night, 8 at a time from sweet pharmaceutical bottles. I make arrangements for a pint-sized journey. I'm the queen of this condition. I'm an expert on making the trip. And now they say I'm an addict. Now they ask why. Why? Don't you know that I promised to die? I'm keeping in practice. I'm merely staying in shape. The pills are a mother, but better, every color and as good as sour balls. I'm on a diet from death.
Class death, however, made Sexton rethink her options. I'm so fascinated with Sylvia Plath's death, the idea of dying perfect, she told her therapist. She felt Plath had chosen an even better woman's way. She had gone out as a sleeping beauty, immaculate even in death. Sexton needed suicide to be painless and leave her unmarked. And by 1974, she had become convinced that dying from car exhaust fumes fit that set of criteria. It would be her town gas. She thought about it, spoke about it with friends. So that's how Sexton took her own life, after taking off her rings and putting on her mother's fur coat. She went to her garage, closed the door, sat in the front seat of her red 1967 Mercury Cougar, and turned on the engine. The difference between her original choice of sleeping pills and carbon monoxide poisoning, of course, is that whereas the former are rarely lethal, carbon monoxide invariably is. She was dead within 15 minutes. But here, Sexton's story converges with Plath's once again. Beginning in 1975, the year after her suicide, automobiles sold in the United States were required to have catalytic converters installed on their exhaust systems. A catalytic converter is a secondary combustion chamber that burns off carbon monoxide and other impurities before they leave the exhaust pipe. The fumes from Sexton's 1967 Cougar would have been thick with carbon monoxide. That's why she could sit in a closed garage with the engine running and be dead within 15 minutes. The exhaust from the 1975 version of that car would have had half as much carbon monoxide, if that. Today's cars emit so little carbon monoxide that the gas barely registers in automobile exhaust at all. It is much more difficult to commit suicide today by turning on your car and closing the door of the garage. Like her friend Sylvia Plath, Sexton was unlucky. She had an impulse coupled with a lethal method just a year before that method stopped being so lethal. Had her difficult 1974 been instead her difficult 1984, she too might have lived much longer. We overhear those two brilliant young poets in the bar at the Ritz, eagerly exchanging stories about their first suicide attempts, and we say that these two do not have long to live. Coupling teaches us the opposite. Don't look at the stranger and jump to conclusions. Look at the stranger's world. Chapter 11, Case Study, The Kansas City Experiments. A century ago, a legendary figure in American law enforcement, a man named O.W. Wilson, came up with the idea of preventive patrol. Wilson believed that having police cars in constant, unpredictable motion throughout a city's streets would deter crime. Any would-be criminal would always have to wonder if a police car was just around the corner. But think about it. When you walk down the street of your neighborhood, do you feel like the police are just around the corner? Cities are vast, sprawling places. It's not obvious that a police force, even a large police force, could ever create the feeling that they were everywhere. This was the question facing the Kansas City Police Department in the early 1970s. The department was about to hire extra police officers, but it was divided over how to deploy them. Should they follow Wilson's advice and have them drive randomly around the city, or assign them to specific locations, such as schools or difficult neighborhoods? To resolve the question, the city hired a criminologist named George Kelling. I reached Kelling by phone to ask him about that time.
One group is saying, riding around in cars doesn't prove anything. It doesn't do anything. Another group saying it's absolutely essential, and that was the standoff. And then I was brought in.
Kelling's idea was to select 15 police beats from the southern part of the city and divide them into three groups. It was a big area, 32 square miles, 150,000 people, good neighborhoods and bad neighborhoods, and even a little farmland on the fringes. One of the three groups would be the control group. Police work would continue there as it always had. In the second neighborhood, Kelling would have no preventive patrol at all. Police officers would respond only when called. But in the third neighborhood, he would double and in some cases triple the number of squad cars on the streets.
Nothing like this had ever been done in policing. At this time, this is 1970, nothing had been written about police tactics. I mean, this was at a very primitive stage in policing.
People like O.W. Wilson had ideas and hunches, but police work was considered an art, not a science that could be evaluated like a new drug. Kelling says that many people told him his experiment would fail, that the police simply weren't ready for research. I wouldn't be able to do it. They'd sabotage it. But Kelling had the backing of the city's police chief. The chief had spent the bulk of his career in the FBI, and he was shocked to learn how little police departments seemed to know about what they did. Many of us in the department, the chief would later admit, had the feeling we were training, equipping, and deploying men to do a job neither we nor anyone else knew much about. He told Kelling to go ahead. Kelling ran the experiment for a year, meticulously collecting every statistic he could on crime in the three areas of the study. The result? Nothing. Burglaries were the same in all three neighborhoods. So were auto thefts, robberies, and vandalism. The citizens in the area with beefed-up patrols didn't feel any safer than the people in the areas with no patrols. They didn't even seem to notice what had happened.
The results were all in one direction, and that was, it doesn't make any difference. It didn't matter to citizen satisfaction. It didn't matter to the crime statistics. It just didn't seem to matter.
Every police chief in the country read the results of Kelling's experiment. Initially, there was disbelief. Some urban police departments were still committed Wilsonites. Kelling remembers the Los Angeles police chief standing up at one national law enforcement conference and saying,
"If those findings are true, every officer in Kansas City was asleep at the switch, because I can assure you that that's not how it is in Los Angeles."
But slowly, resistance gave way to resignation. The study came out as violent crime was beginning its long, hard two-decade surge across the United States. And it fed into the growing feeling among people in law enforcement that the task before them was overwhelming. They had thought they could prevent crime with police patrols, but now the Kansas City Police Department had tested that assumption empirically, and patrols turned out to be a charade. And if patrols didn't work, what did? Lee Brown, chief of the New York City Police Department, gave a famous interview in the middle of the crack epidemic in which he all but threw up his hands. "This country's social problems are well beyond the ability of the police to deal with on their own," Brown said. He had read George Kelling's Kansas City report. It was hopeless. "No matter how many police officers a city had," Brown said, "you could never have enough to use traditional policing techniques to deter crime. If you don't have a police officer to cover every part of the city all the time, the chance of an officer on patrol coming across a crime in progress is very small." In 1990, President George H.W. Bush came to Kansas City. He spent the morning in one of the city's poorest and most violent neighborhoods, then gave a speech to a group of local police officers. He tried to be upbeat. He failed. The homicide rate that year in Kansas City was 3 times the national average. It would go up again in 1991, and again in 1992, then once more in 1993. There wasn't much to say.
"A 4-year-old boy shot dead in a suspected crack house. An 11-year-old kid gunned down outside another drug den, allegedly at the hands of a 14-year-old guard."
Halfway through his remarks, Bush was reduced to simply listing the terrible things happening on a city's streets.
"The downtown bar, a mother sells her baby for crack. And a firebombing leaves 3 generations dead, including a grandmother and 3 little kids. The headlines are horrifying, sickening, outrageous."
But in the early 1990s, 20 years after the first Kansas City experiment, Kansas City decided to try again. They hired another brilliant young criminologist named Lawrence Sherman. As they had with George Kelling, they gave him free rein. It was time for Kansas City experiment number 2. Why not? Nothing else was working. Lawrence Sherman thought the focus ought to be on guns. He believed the sheer number of guns in the city was what fueled its epidemic of violence. His plan was to try a number of ideas in sequence, then rigorously evaluate their effectiveness, as Kelling had done, and pick a winner. He called a planning meeting with a group of the city's senior police officers. They chose as their testing ground Patrol District 144, a small neighborhood of modest single-family homes bounded to the south by 39th Street and to the west by Highway 71. District 144 was as bad as Kansas City got in the early 1990s. The homicide rate there was 20 times the national average. The area averaged one violent felony a day and 24 drive-by shootings a year. A third of the lots were vacant. Just a few months before, an officer had been on patrol through 144 when he saw some kids playing basketball in the street. He stopped, got out, and asked them to move. One of the kids threw the basketball at his head. Then two others jumped him. It was that kind of place. Sherman's first idea was for two-man teams to knock on every door in the neighborhood over a three-month period. The officers would introduce themselves, talk about gun violence, and give the residents a flyer with an 800 number on it. If they heard anything about guns, they were encouraged to call in an anonymous tip. The plan went off without a hitch. In many of the visits, the officers were trailed by a graduate student in criminology, James Shaw, whose job it was to evaluate the program's effectiveness. Sometimes the officers stayed for as long as 20 minutes, chatting with people who had never had a police officer come to their door other than to make an arrest. In his subsequent write-up, Shaw was effusive. The police went to every residents in that community, some more than once, and talked to residents in a friendly, non-threatening manner. In response, people were very receptive and glad to see the police going door to door. People frequently responded with comments like, "God bless you all," and "We should have had a program like this before," or "Thank God, I didn't think you all would ever come." In the end, 88% of the people said they would use the hotline if they saw any guns. So how many calls came in after 858 door-to-door visits over 3 months? Two calls, and both were about guns in another neighborhood. The problem, everyone soon realized, was not that the residents of District 144 didn't want to help. They did. The problem was that they never left their houses. "It's starting to sound like Beirut around here," one homeowner told Shaw. "And if you're so scared that you never leave your house, how on earth do you know who has guns or not?" Shaw wrote, "Not unlike residents in many other inner-city neighborhoods, these people have become caged animals in their own homes. Bars on the windows are the norm. One is not surprised even to see bars on second-story windows. More dismal, however, is the fact that in house after house, the blinds are drawn and drapes closed up tightly, blocking out any trace of the outside world. These elderly people lock themselves up and shut themselves in. They hear the world outside, and it sometimes sounds like a battle zone, but they can't see anything." Sherman's next idea was to train officers in the subtle art of spotting concealed weapons. The impetus came from a New York City police officer named Robert T. Gallagher, who in 18 years on the force had disarmed an astonishing 1,200 people. Gallagher had elaborate theories worked out over many years. Street criminals overwhelmingly put their guns in their waistbands on the left side, in the case of a right-hander, causing a subtle but discernible hitch in their stride. The leg on the gun side takes a shorter step than the leg on the non-gun side, and the corresponding arm also follows a constrained trajectory. When stepping off curbs or getting out of a car, Gallagher believed, gun carriers invariably glance towards their weapons or unconsciously adjust them. Gallagher flew to Kansas City with great fanfare the month after the failed hotline experiment. He gave seminars. He made videos. The officers took notes. The television program 2020 sent a camera crew to record the technique in action on the streets of Kansas City. Nobody spotted anything. 2020 came back again. The same thing happened. Nothing. Whatever magical skills Robert T. Gallagher possessed were not, apparently, transferable to the beat cops of Kansas City. Two of the team's best ideas for curbing gun violence had failed. They had one idea left. The winning entry in the Kansas City gun experiment was deceptively simple. It was based on a quirk in the American legal system. The Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution protects citizens from unreasonable searches and seizures. That's why the police cannot search your home without a warrant. On the street, a police officer must have a good reason, reasonable suspicion, to frisk you. But if you're in your car, that standard is not at all hard for a police officer to meet. Traffic codes in the U.S., and in fact in most countries, give police officers literally hundreds of reasons to stop a motorist. There are moving violations, speeding, running a red light. There are equipment violations, a light that doesn't work, and a tire not quite right, legal scholar David Harris writes. And then there are catch-all provisions, rules that allow police to stop drivers for conduct that complies with all the rules on the book, but that officers consider imprudent or unreasonable under the circumstances, or that describes the offense in language so broad as to make a violation virtually coextensive with the officer's unreviewable personal judgment. There was even a Supreme Court case in which a police officer in North Carolina stopped what he thought was a suspicious driver using the pretext that one of the car's brake lights had broken. As it turns out, it's perfectly permissible in North Carolina to drive with one brake light out so long as the other one works. So what happened after the driver of the car sued, claiming he had been stopped illegally? The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the officer. It was enough that he thought driving with only one brake light seemed like an infraction. In other words, police officers in the United States not only have at their disposal a virtually limitless list of legal reasons to stop a motorist, they are also free to add any other reasons they might dream up, so long as they seem reasonable. And once they've stopped a motorist, police officers are allowed, under the law, to search the car, as long as they have reason to believe the motorist might be armed or dangerous. Kansas City decided to take advantage of this latitude. Sherman's proposal was for the police department to detail four officers in two squad cars. Their beat would be District 144. They were told not to stray outside the area's 0.64 square miles. They were freed from all other law enforcement obligations. They didn't have to answer radio calls or rush to accident scenes. Their instructions were clear. Watch out for what you think are suspicious-looking drivers. Use whatever pretext you can find in the traffic code to pull them over. If you're still suspicious, search the car and confiscate any weapon you find. The officers worked every night from 7 p.m. to 1 a.m., 7 days a week, for 200 consecutive days. And what happened? Outside District 144, where police business was conducted as usual, crime remained as bad as ever, but inside 144, all of the new focus police work cut gun crimes, shootings, murders, woundings in half. Remember, the police had all but given up by that point. Hotline? Nobody calls it. Concealed weapons detection? A crew from 2020 comes down and twice goes home empty-handed. Lee Brown, up in New York City, was mourning the powerlessness of the police to do anything serious about violent crime. Everyone remembered the previous Kansas City experiment, which had plunged the law enforcement community into 20 years of despair. But now, the same city had come back, and this time, they were declaring victory. I don't know why it didn't occur to us to really focus on guns, the Kansas City police chief said after the results came in. He was as stunned as everyone else at what two extra patrol cars had accomplished. We usually focus on getting the bad guys after a crime. Maybe going after guns was too simplistic for us. The first Kansas City experiment said that preventive patrol was useless, that having more police cars driving around made no difference. The second Kansas City experiment amended that position. Actually, extra patrol cars did make a difference, so long as officers took the initiative and stopped anyone they thought suspicious, and as long as they got out of their cars as much as possible and went out of their way to look for weapons. Patrol worked if the officers were busy. The statistics from the final report on the experiment were eye-opening. Over the 7 months, each patrol car issued an average of 5.45 traffic citations per shift. They averaged 2.23 arrests per night. In just 200 days, the four officers had done more policing than most officers of that era did in their entire careers. 1,090 traffic citations, 948 vehicle stops, 616 arrests, 532 pedestrian checks, and 29 guns seized.